You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Coming up next, Economics for the People with your hosts, Sirisha Naidu and Taki Manolakos.
Nos dices que debemos sentarnos, pero las ideas solo pueden levantarnos, caminar, recorrer, no rendirse ni retroceder, ver, aprender como esponja absorbe. Nadie sobre todos, faltan todos, suman todos para todos, todo para nosotros. Soñamos en grande que se.
Welcome to all our listeners. I'm Sirisha and Taki's here today. Taki, what do we have on our show today?
Well, this past Monday, January 15th, was Martin Luther King Day, and we're going to be discussing Dr. King's rich intellectual, political, and economic legacy. As you know, Dr. King had a lot to say about U.S. war in Vietnam. He had a lot to say about militarism, and he had a lot to say about capitalism. And unfortunately, given the state of our country and the state of the international situation, his thinking remains very relevant to us today still. In our regular Dollars and Cents debrief segment, co-editor Chris Sturr interviews assistant editor of Jacobin magazine, Nick French, about the burden of student debt.
And this is a very important issue, something that is education and knowledge, which benefits all of society. We have made it almost unaffordable for many people to get an education.
Yes. And the Biden administration, unfortunately, hasn't been able to do much.
Yeah, unfortunately. And then in our feature this month, we have a conversation lined up with Professor Clara Irazabal, the director of the Urban Studies and Planning Program at the University of Maryland, College Park. And she used to teach at University of Missouri, Kansas City as well. And we discuss the history of the Latino community in Kansas City and how its formation and how the changes in the community in Kansas City have responded to the global forces of capitalism.
Be sure to follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, where our handle is Economics for the People. We post all the podcasts there and post updates. You can also reach us via email if you have questions, if you have comments, anything you want to communicate to us. We're available. We have an email address and we'll respond quickly. Our email address is econforthepeople@gmail.com. That's econforthepeople@gmail.com.
And be sure to let us know if there are topics that you want us to cover.
All right, let's go. We got a great show.
Last week, we commemorated Martin Luther King Day.
Yes, we did indeed. But I would like to quote another great revolutionary from 1917 as a caution. During the lifetime of great revolutionaries, the oppressing classes constantly hounded them, received their theories with the most savage malice, the most furious hatred, and the most unscrupulous campaigns of lies and slander. After their death, attempts are made to convert them into harmless icons, to canonize them, so to say, and to hallow their names to a certain extent for the consolation of the oppressed classes and with the object of duping the latter, while at the same time robbing the revolutionary theory of its substance, blunting its revolutionary edge, and vulgarizing it.
Yes, Taki, that's an excellent quote. And how unpopular Dr. King was in establishment circles in his day. Over time, of course, it became the norm to find some quote to commemorate Dr. King, but rob it of its revolutionary theory and substance.
Dr. King's incredibly important and inspiring work in the civil rights movement was also his staunch opposition to war and imperialism, something that is often forgotten today. And his incredibly important work on economic justice for poor people of all racialized and ethnic groups. And this is significantly relevant to the present time. His speech, now titled Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence, was delivered in New York on April 4, 1967, exactly 1 year before he was assassinated, and it marked an important moment when he publicly announced his opposition to the Vietnam War, a then unpopular stance for which he received a lot of flack. It also marked an important decision to take a stand on a so-called international issue and U.S. imperialism.
This thing on international issue needs to be underscored. Now, Dr. Vincent Harding, who was a close associate of Dr. King and his former speechwriter and the first director of the Martin Luther King Memorial Center in Atlanta, said this in an interview on Democracy Now! In 2008, and I quote, "It's important that King saw these issues not simply as what we call foreign policy issues. King was most deeply a pastor, and King saw these issues in terms of what they were doing to the poorest, weakest, most vulnerable people in this country, as well as what they were doing to the poor of other countries, particularly in this case, Vietnam. So King did not see himself as separating his attention from this country and turning it overseas. King saw the natural connection between what was happening to the poor in the USA, why young men and women were rising up in anger, frustration, desperation, saw that action as deeply related to the attention that the country was paying to the devastation it was doing in Vietnam. And so Dr. King was actually trying to bring the country together to sense this relationship between its sickness at home to the sickness of its policy overseas," end quote.
Yes, and he really drew the connections. Notice that Dr. King recognized war's devastating impact on the poor in the U.S. and in Vietnam. And he was able to connect the dots between the political economy of war to the political economy of poverty.
And I want to quote, and you know, this Econ 101 were going to use a lot of quotes. So I want to quote another speech of Dr. King's, which was given in 1967, and it's called The Other America. And Dr. King had this to say, and it's such a beautiful quote. And I quote, "There are literally two Americas. One America is beautiful for our situation. And in a sense, this America is overflowing with the miracle of prosperity and the honey of opportunity. This America is the habitat of millions of people who have food and material necessities for their bodies and culture and education for their minds and freedom and human dignity for the spirit. In this America, millions of people experience every day the opportunity of having life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in all their dimensions. And in this America, millions of young people grow up in the sunlight of opportunity. But tragically and unfortunately, there is another America. This other America has a daily ugliness about it that constantly transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair. In this America, millions of work-starved men walk the streets daily in search for jobs that do not exist. In this America, millions of people find themselves living in rat-infested, vermin-filled slums. In this America, people are poor by the millions, and they find themselves perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. And as we look at this other America, we see it as an arena of blasted hopes and shattered dreams. Many people of various backgrounds live in this other America. Some are Mexican-American, some are Puerto Ricans, some are Indians, some happen to be from other groups. Millions of them are Appalachian whites, probably the largest group in this other America in proportion to its size and population is the American Negro." End quote. And he continues, I quote again, "But we must see that the struggle today is much more difficult. It's more difficult today because we are struggling now for genuine equality, and it's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good, solid job. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee the right to live in sanitary, decent housing conditions. It is much easier to integrate a public park than it is to make genuine quality integrated education a reality, end quote.
What a powerful quote that richly captures the reality of class and race in the country, both in the 60s and today, because we find ourselves in the year 2024, 67 years after his speech. We find ourselves in a situation where working class black, white, brown, American Indian communities living in the U.S. struggle because they do not have good quality education or affordable housing. We are being asked to believe that the side hustle should make up for the insufficient wages in our regular jobs. And there are a growing number of people in this country who do not have secure, well-paying, quality jobs that can offer them a decent standard of living. And they instead rely on gig work, constantly hustling. The data on this point are very clear, okay? That for the second quarter of 2023 through June 30th, I'm going to give you some data on wealth inequality in the U.S. The top 10% of households by wealth had $7 million on average. As a group, they held 69% of the total wealth. The bottom 50%, okay, this number just knocked my boots off. The bottom 50% of households as a group holds only 2.5% of total wealth. I want to repeat that. The bottom 50% of households as a group holds 2.5% of total wealth.
And Taki, I want to just interject and say, when we're talking about total wealth, we're talking about total wealth in the U.S., in the entire country.
We're talking about the country, yes. And this reminds me of the term, the dual economy. Dr. King does not use this term, but economists, particularly in the global south, the countries of Africa, Asia, and Latin America that were subject to European colonialism, often use it to describe two entirely different sectors in an economy that are characterized by different economic, social characteristics and face different technological characteristics.
So the first America that Dr. King describes is still flourishing. They get to engage in luxury travel to space in the midst of the global COVID pandemic. When the world was in a state of suspension, people didn't know how to make ends meet. Frontline workers, garbage workers, delivery truck workers, and others were the ones that kept the economy running. Medical professionals were working overtime to treat those afflicted with COVID and sometimes succumbing to it themselves. Technology for this America enhances their quality of life, their ability to engage in leisure and frivolity. But technology for the other America, as Dr. King calls it, and the other America still exists. So technology for the other America means greater surveillance at their place of work as ways to give up information to companies so that companies can persuade them to buy more, to crave a lifestyle of celebrities that is out of reach for most. And we had Zoe Sherman in our second episode of our show who discussed this at some length. And this is very clear in the data. And this is the other America that is not flourishing in the same way. They are struggling to find affordable housing, having to hustle because their jobs don't pay well. The kids suffer from lack of good public education. And we really have to think about how this still holds true. Why are workers today trying to ask and demand for more?
Yes, I mean, I think that's very eloquent. By 1968, Dr. King was increasingly voicing opposition to American intervention in Vietnam. But his focus on poverty in the U.S. increasingly led him to seek a broad, cross-racial coalition, an intercultural coalition. Not only did he travel to Memphis to support the striking sanitation workers, but a month before his assassination, on March 14, 1968, he organized a summit, a meeting with more than 70 leaders of various communities, including Chicanos, Iroquois, representatives of the Native peoples of the Dakotas, leaders of the Highlander Center in Tennessee, activists in Chicago who were fighting for economic justice among poor white people, to plan for a poor people's march. Dr. King noted at that meeting, and I quote, "The tragedy is that the workings of our economy so often pit the white poor and the black poor against each other at the bottom of society. The tragedy is that groups only one generation removed from poverty themselves, haunted by the memory of scarcity and fearful of slipping back, step on the fingers of those struggling up the ladder. End quote. And here he's connecting the dots again between the political economy of racism and the political economy of poverty.
And Taki, can you tell us a little bit about what political economy is?
That's a difficult question. I'll try and answer as briefly as I can. So political economy is kind of a synthesis of economics and politics. And it's a form of analysis in which we try to integrate an understanding of political factors that influence outcome and economic factors that influence outcomes. Economists tend to be very hard-headed sometimes. They think it's all just economics, but it's not really. Politics itself is also very important, and we want to take that into account.
Okay. The Freedom Budget, co-authored by Philip Randolph, Barnyard, Rustin, and Dr. King, focuses on jobs and the creation of jobs. It offered a straightforward federal jobs guarantee plan that would create jobs by budgeting for more government investment in quality, affordable housing, good quality public education, and mitigate the effects of poor quality air and water. So they were even thinking about what we now call as environmental issues, but anyone who has to live in these conditions know that they are everyday conditions of life, that we do need clean water and air. So in addition to putting in place minimum wage that will provide for workers and the provision of a safety net, the Freedom Budget calls for federal jobs guarantee program. And all of these continue to be relevant even today. And just as a side note, I want to mention that the Freedom Budget was written in the time between two of the most devastating race riots, one in Los Angeles in 1965 and the other in Detroit 2 years later. So some version of a jobs guarantee program was pursued by President Roosevelt, in which any person who sought a job could secure one. This resulted in the Works Progress Administration, what many people know as WPA, and the Civilian Conservation Corps, which many people refer to as CCC. And these were of tremendous help to working people during the Great Depression. Now, the idea of a federal jobs guarantee program has been pursued by many economists, including some of my colleagues at University of Missouri, Kansas City, or UMKC. And a federal jobs guarantee program would not only benefit all working people, white, black, brown, American Indians, but as economists William Darity and Derek Hamilton have argued, it will significantly mitigate racial disparities in health.
And it may be useful to know, why is it that capitalism may not be able to generate sufficient jobs, and more importantly, jobs that satisfy the needs of people? What must change in our economic and political situation to make that happen? That is the critical and key and essential question. And how can we make that happen for all working people? And in this, the rise of the labor movement the past few years is significant in demanding that workers be treated with dignity, and that includes being paid decent wages. And some of these movements are challenging how we think about organizing across racial, ethnic lines and generations. In Kansas City, we have Stand Up KC, which organizes black, brown, and white workers for better pay and work conditions. And we also have KC Tenants, which organizes for housing as a human right.
Okay, so, you know, and again, I want to emphasize again what Taki said, which is that we have to really think about, why is it that our economic system is unable to make good, well-paying jobs available for everyone? So, you know, as economists, we really want to pay attention to this, ask questions, and then find ways in which we can change the situation to make good life for all working people. Coming back to this celebration of MLK Day, such an important reminder of the work of Dr. King, and that Dr. King's proposals serve as a starting point for an alternative that will disrupt the economic and physical and psychological violence of poverty, racism, imperialism, and capitalism.
As Brandon Terry notes in a Boston Review article from 2018, we need to start treating Dr. King not merely as an icon to quote, but as a thinker and public philosopher to engage.
This is the DNS Debrief from Dollars and Cents Magazine.
Hello, I'm Chris Sturr, and I'm co-editor of Dollars and Cents, and I'm here speaking with Nick French, who's an associate editor at Jacobin Magazine, about his recent article in DNS called The Heavy Unequal Burden of Student Debt. Welcome, Nick.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Why don't we just start out with the Biden administration and what Biden promised to do when he ran for president and what he has done and whether it's enough?
So I believe when he was running for president, he promised to forgive $10,000 for all individuals making under a certain income threshold, up to $20,000, I think, for households. Of course, you know, during the campaign, Bernie Sanders had proposed to cancel all student debt. Elizabeth Warren also had a student debt cancellation plan that was much more generous than Biden's. And in August 2022, the Biden administration announced that it was going to move forward with this plan to cancel $10,000 to $20,000 of debt for borrowers making under $125,000 a year or married couples making under $250,000. You know, basically, the administration cited this emergency authorization that it was saying that COVID was a national emergency that justified them in forgiving student debt. The Supreme Court, of course, struck that down. So that plan has been held up. The Biden administration is now trying to use some other authorization to pass through that plan. Basically, they have forgiven some debt. As I say in the article, they have approved something on the order of tens of billions of dollars for various categories of borrowers. You know, they're sort of specific things, like if you went to a school and took out debt to go to a school that was, you know, later found to be breaking the law or that shut down, you know, a lot of these private for-profit colleges and universities, right. They've done expansion of income-driven repayment plans, public service loan forgiveness program, forgiving people who have total and permanent disabilities. But it's been much more targeted and very much different from the broad-based student loan forgiveness that he promised in his campaign. And as we'll talk about it, he's basically just not doing much for most borrowers. Right. The people are really impacted by this.
So the pandemic era debt repayment hiatus, right, has been ended. And so you talk to some economists about what the impact of that would be, because you would think with so much money involved and so many people involved, it might have some macroeconomic effects, right? Especially while the U.S. economy is kind of teetering on recession, although looking a little bit better recently. But you wouldn't want to throw it into recession with this. But you got kind of mixed answers from the economists. What did they tell you?
Yeah, I mean, when I started thinking about this, I thought it really doesn't look good. A total of $1.64 trillion in federal student loan debt that is going back into repayment. That affects 43.6 million Americans. Mm-hmm. So that averages out to $38,000 in federal debt per borrower. So yeah, I sort of thought, you know, this big repayment restart when the economy is still on kind of shaky footing could have a really bad impact. But yeah, I talked to Marshall Steinbaum at the University of Utah, who's worked a lot on student debt. Josh Mason, a progressive economist at John Jay College here in New York. And both of them basically said there's probably not going to be a big immediate impact from restarting student loan payments. What you have instead is just people will start accumulating debt again. Mm-hmm. This sort of fits with an analysis that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York did last year, which also based on a survey of a nationally representative survey estimated that, you know, the impact on consumer spending was of the payment restart was not going to be very significant. What these economists told me was that the real impacts are going to be kind of long term, like as debt accumulates over time, that affects people's abilities to make choices like moving to a new city, maybe taking on jobs or careers that aren't as well paying, affects people's ability to buy homes, potentially And overall can have a kind of like long-term drag on economic dynamism, long-term impacts on people's lives moving forward.
So the other thing that your piece emphasizes is that these burdens are not felt equally. So maybe you could talk about which groups, on which groups do the burdens of debt repayment fall most heavily?
Well, I have to say it's not that surprising. You know, the numbers are striking, but in terms of the groups who it affects, it's basically what you'd expect. So the burden falls more heavily on women than men. There are also racial disparities, falls more heavily on Black and Latino borrowers than on white borrowers. Do some cross analysis there. Black women are the group that has the greatest debt burden. Just to rattle off some of those numbers, women with a bachelor's degree owe on average $2,700 more on student loans than men who have a bachelor's. They also take longer to pay off that debt than men do. Black male borrowers carry on average almost $6,000 more in student debt than white men. You have a similar disparity between Black women and white women. So Black women borrowers owe on average $37,558, which is roughly $2,000 more than the average for Black men, $6,000 more than for white women, and $8,000 more than for white women. You really see the burden of student debt kind of reproducing and perpetuating historic economic disparities of race and gender. Like I said, not too surprising. And you know, because we have racial pay gaps, gendered pay gaps, that manifests in it's, you know, they take on more debt and then it's also harder for them to pay it back.
Right, right. So just to finish up, you make this very interesting point that I'm hoping you can expand on. You end up talking about the case for Biden just eliminating student debt, and you assert that he has the power to do so. So maybe you could talk about that. But you make this really interesting point that one of the best arguments for the government eliminating that debt is, as you put it, much of the debt would not be paid back in any case. So why do you say that?
Yeah, I mean, this was also something that I didn't really realize until I talked to some of these economists and started looking into this issue more closely. But Marshall Steinbaum, who I talked to, did some research through the Jain Family Institute with some other economists, Edward Nilaj, Sergio Pinto, and Laura Beamer. And they found basically that the effect of the federal student loan payment pause was to finally allow borrowers who hadn't been paying down their balances to finally start paying down those balances. What they found was that for many borrowers, the burden of debt was just so heavy that they, you know, even if they were paying, they couldn't keep up with the interest that was accruing. So basically just the debt burdens are just too big for many people to pay back. One of the borrowers I talked to, this was their situation. They basically said, I don't really have any hope of paying this back if it's not forgiven. So basically what happens is with restarting the federal student loan payments, assuming there isn't across the board forgiveness, we're just going to see a lot of people continue to accumulate debt. So it's not really, you know, it's not good for them. It's not good for the economy, but the federal government isn't, you know, they're not getting this money back.
Right.
So it would be better to just, you know, stop harming people, you know, stop harming people's credit scores, stop imposing these debt burdens on them. That's the argument.
Yeah. It's a terrible situation for so many people. It's completely puzzling. And people are now talking about the fact that this is the kind of policy, along with the government's policy actions in supporting Israel and Gaza, you know, that's going to really harm Biden's reelection chances with young people. So it's just unaccountable. Anyway, well, thanks a lot. People can find your article in the January-February issue of Dollars and Cents. Listeners can subscribe at dollarsandcents.org. And it's not posted to the website yet, but I may post it in the coming weeks. So thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Chris.
This has been the DNS Debrief from Dollars and Cents Magazine. For more economic analysis, visit dollarsandcents.org.
So we're very excited to have with us Dr. Clara Irazabal Zurita, Professor of Urban Studies and Planning at University of Maryland and Director of their Urban Studies and Planning Program. Prior to University of Maryland, Professor Irazabal was actually at University of Missouri, Kansas City, UMKC, where Taki and I first met her. And she was the Director of the Latinx and Latin American Studies Program and a Professor of Urban Planning there. Professor Irazabal, in her two decades of work, has explored social and spatial justice through the lens of urban planning and design. She's the author of City Making and Urban Governance in the Americas and has written and spoken extensively on the cultural, economic, political, and racial issues that shape urban enclaves. Clara, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Clara.
Thank you for having me.
So, Clara, let's just get right into it. You have written extensively on many subjects, but what we would like to narrow in on today is specifically the Latinx community in Kansas City. Now, in your work on Kansas City, you divide historically the past 100 years or so into three time periods, which I think is very fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about what are these three important time periods and why did you divide the history of Latinos and Latinas in Greater Kansas City in this manner?
Yes. Before I do that, let me start by recognizing the co-author of this work with me, that is a student of economics, a PhD student of economics at UMKC, Alejandro Garay. And what we did is to use the social structures of accumulation as a framework with which to examine the different historical periods that had happened in Kansas City regarding different institutional arrangements that affect the economic, social, and political conditions, and how that affected Latinos and Latinos in their well-being, their community development, and their placemaking, the way that they create and occupy space in the city. And the three periods that you're referring to are as follows. First, we had a monopolistic social structures of accumulations that happened between the 1870s and the 1930s. Because of the way institutions were arranged then, and we can go into that. Then we had a second period that we identified as the Keynesian period of 1940s to 1970s. And the most recent one that we are still living is the neoliberal social structure of accumulation period that started in the 1980s and is ongoing.
Clara, so can you tell us what this social structures of accumulation is for our listeners, of a very brief explanation of that?
Yes, it's this idea that in different historical periods, you will have different compositions of institutions in societies that determine conditions under which people live. Those affect the economic, the social, the political, the cultural conditions, and they affect different groups of people differently. And that's what we wanted to examine, focusing on Latinos in this case.
Thank you, Clara. And by institutions, of course, you mean, again, social institutions, political institutions, and so on. Very, very fascinating. In your first time period, monopolistic time period of 1870s to 1930s, when Kansas City was the second largest railroad center at that time after Chicago. So what was the role played by the monopoly held by the railroad company in developing Kansas City in the way it was, and particularly in its impact on the Latinos in Kansas City?
Yes, well, it developed in general a very large role in the recomposition of the economic integration of the city to larger regions, different regions within the United States, and also its linkage to Mexico, opening new opportunities for the trade of commodities and also the flow of labor. And that led to labor exploitation, and it was also founded on labor exploitation because the railroad company hired Mexican workers for the most undesirable and dangerous jobs, paying them low wages and providing them poor living conditions. These conditions happened in what they called self-sufficient camps, encampments for its Mexican workers, which isolated them from the rest of the city and reinforced racial discrimination and racial sentiments. On the flip side, though, those encampments created opportunities for Latinos to create a sense of community, to create a sense of place, to develop what they ultimately called a traquero culture, people that worked on the tracks of the railroad, a traquero culture and a sense of solidarity that led to other opportunities for these communities.
You were talking about the railroad tracks. So one of the neighborhoods that developed as a result of this was Argentine, which lies in Kansas City, Kansas. And for our listeners who do not live in Kansas City or do not know, a large portion of Kansas City lies in the state of Missouri and a portion of it lies in Kansas. So the railroad company and the process that you just described actually developed the neighborhood of Argentine, which is close to this railroad track. And also, you write about how Westside, which is located in Kansas City, Missouri, also became a space where Latinos gathered and built their communities. How did that all come about? You know, how did it impact this demographic composition? You started to talk about it, but maybe if you can expand on it a little bit more.
Yes, the heart of the railroad track company and their operations in Kansas City happened right at the border of these two cities that you named. Both are named Kansas City, but one is in the state of Kansas and one is in the state of Missouri. Around that railroad track center and encampment, the first wave of Latino settlements occurred in the early 1900s. Because these operations attracted Mexican immigrants that were hired as laborers for the railroad company, and the establishment of the segregated camps that I referred to started to happen. These were self-sufficient camps exclusively for Mexican workers, which isolated them from locals and enforced racial segregation in the city. The railroad company also had other roles because at the time of the depressions, both in 1921 and the Great Depression of the 1930s, it reduced its labor force and salaries, and it caused many Mexican workers to lose their jobs. And the company also played a role in returning some of these laborers to Mexico, with the assistance of the Mexican consulate and the Chamber of Commerce. The Mexicans that remained and that still had jobs in this company also, on the other side, had the opportunity to start different types of occupations, diversifying in the meat packing, construction, agriculture, and service industries.
Clara, you described the living conditions of these working class Mexicans, and you described them as camps. Can you maybe just very briefly talk about what living conditions were like in these camps?
Very, very poor conditions. The Mexican workers needed to make do on their own. Sometimes they use old wagons of the trains that they recomposed as part of their settlements, their own houses. They were crowded. They didn't have running waters or other services. They only were allowed to buy the food that was provided in their little bodegas that they had in the settlements, and they had to pay expensive amounts of money for that. It was very difficult, very hard, and they were restricted from living those circumstances. So they didn't have choices, they didn't have alternatives, and it was tremendously difficult for these workers and their families.
And these neighborhoods of Argentine and Westside, Argentine in Kansas City, Kansas, and Westside in Kansas City, Missouri, were they just composed of working class Mexicans? Were there any kind of class distinction among the Mexicans who came to Kansas City? Was it a much more homogenous group?
Well, yes, little by little, they became diversified to some wealthier Mexicans, including hacendados, people that own land, mm-hmm. professionals and businessmen also settled, particularly in the West Side, which ultimately became the economic and political center of the Mexican community, and it remains so to a large extent until today. Also, some white Americans owned some commercial and professional establishments in the West Side and other Latino neighborhoods, and some Latinos themselves ended up purchasing housing from other immigrant groups that in turn were leaving these areas and moving to other areas of the city or to the suburbs altogether, including groups of Italians and Greeks.
The way that you have tried to give us a picture of Kansas City is not just that the city is developing outside of the larger economic, political, social forces in the global stage. The second time period that you talk about is Keynesian period of the post-war period, which is 1940 to 1970s. And you try and locate Kansas City, what is happening in this period where nationally, and if our listeners may recall, the federal government in the U.S. and many other parts of the world adopted the ideas of the economist J.M. Keynes to lift their economies out of the Great Depression through government expenditure on welfare and infrastructural programs supporting the industrial sector. This was also a period of the rise of the U.S. on the world stage as a country with significant economic, cultural, and military power. So you locate what happens in Kansas City during this time. Can you tell us what was happening in this period of 1940 to 1970s?
Yes, the Keynesian essays of that post-war period had mixed impacts on the greater Kansas City area and mixed impacts on different groups in this metro area, especially on its Latino communities. On the one hand, that social structure of accumulation stimulated economic growth and urban development in the region, creating new employment opportunities, new infrastructure, new public services, and some Latinos and other groups benefited from all of these new opportunities created. On the other hand, though, that social structure of accumulation also intensified racial segregation and discrimination against Latinos and other groups who faced exclusion from new markets of housing and education, and opportunities for political participation that also opened up during that era. Latinos, in turn, responded to these challenges by helping themselves through the forming of mutual aid societies, cultural organizations, their participation in the civil rights movement, and other ways of asserting their identity and rights as workers and citizens.
And you've been talking about racial segregation. And Kansas City, for instance, is one of the most segregated, or in the top 10, I believe, segregated cities in the country. Real estate barons and developers played a very, very important role in this. So how did Latinos resist this attempt at disciplining working class people and a racialized people?
As I said before, Latinos resisted this in several ways. Perhaps the most important one was the creation of institutions and organizations and groups organizing and mobilizing. Latinos created community organizations such as one that persists until today, Guadalupe Center, the West Side Community Action Network, and the Hispanic Economic Development Corporation. Those communities helped them group and advocate for their rights and their interests. They also participated in protests and boycotts and lawsuits to challenge discriminatory practices and policies. Another way in which they resisted these was through the creation and preservation of cultural spaces. They infused their neighborhoods with cultural expressions such as murals and festivals and music to celebrate their identity and heritage. They also fought to preserve their settlements, their historical landmarks such as the West Side and the Argentine neighborhoods that we mentioned, because they were at risk of demolition and gentrification. They continue to be at risk of gentrification, and they continue to receive these trends that can displace Latinos from these communities. And then ultimately, they built and continue to build social networks, maintaining strong ties not only with their family, their friends, and their neighbors, but also strategically with other ethnic and racial groups to support each other and share resources and resist some of these challenges. They also established and continue to nurture transnational connections with their countries of origin, sending remittances, engaging in cultural exchanges, traveling back and forth, and all the rest that support their emotional well-being, but also strengthen their political opportunities.
And this is so important, Clara, just what you said. People want to lift themselves up economically, the ways in which they have to also engage in the political sphere, the cultural sphere, or not just that they have to, they have. It's not a prescription. This is what people have done. That so much of this is intertwined, the political, the economic, the social, the cultural, and the transnational. So thank you for that.
So Clara, you've described so far two institutional configurations, the monopolistic one and the Keynesian one, which you elaborated upon at length. Just to get ready to describe the third one, can you give our listeners a brief explanation of neoliberalism? What is that?
Oh, my goodness. I think that you're a better position to do that than I am, because you're an economist. But it represents the retraction of the state and all of its political role in developing communities and providing infrastructure and social supports. It leaves people to fend for themselves, and at the same time it creates and enlarges and protects opportunities for larger companies and transnational corporations and trade, favoring companies that have power at the expense of the weakest link in our society.
Given that brief explanation, why don't you tell us what happened during the neoliberal SSA that came after the Keynesian one?
Well, let me start by telling you a little bit, though, about how these social structures of accumulation periods affected immigration patterns in KC. It's important to acknowledge that during this period, there was an increase in immigration from Mexico and Central America to Kansas City due to this global economic crisis, structural adjustment policies, and also conditions in those countries, civil wars in particular in Central America. Many people migrated to the U.S. in search of better opportunities. That not only included from more areas in Mexico, particularly rural areas, but also people from countries such as Guatemala, which ultimately diversified the Latino population, which had been almost exclusively Mexican up until this point. And it diversified the population demographically in terms of national origin and language and culture and class, but also in place base, as some of the newcomers settled in the traditional Latino neighborhoods that we have been speaking about, but also others moved to suburban areas and other parts of the city, so that today we have a Latino community that is much more dispersed and diverse in the Kansas City metro area. Also, the strengthening and the growth of the transnational communities, those connections of those newcomers with their original lands and communities continued to grow. And that, of course, created both opportunities and challenges for the Latino community development and Latino urbanism. On the one hand, Latinos created in the city a new type of cultural vitality, creating new businesses, organizations, and spaces, engaging in political activism and civil participation. And on the other hand, many of these communities of Latinos continue to face or started to face new types of discrimination, exploitation, poverty, and lack of access to services and resources, particularly newcomers and those that were considered unauthorized.
Clara, I just want to acknowledge how much you're connecting, because when you said that immigration was taking place from various parts of Latin America, you were also tying it to the neoliberal period where there was structural adjustment programs, and these structural adjustment programs was this imposition of neoliberal economic policies, particularly in the countries of the Global South, and Latin America was quite significantly impacted by that. Just to remind our listeners, you described neoliberalism as privileging big companies and big corporations over and above people and communities, and that happened not just in the US but in other parts of the world, and that actually squeezed people, forced them to look for better opportunities for themselves and their families, and we see that impact of it in Kansas City, and you so expertly described some of those processes that we have observed and experienced in Kansas City, so thank you for that. Now, this neoliberal period was also characterized by large-scale so-called revitalization projects in Kansas City. Would you very briefly tell us what these projects were, and then what impacts did these have on the residents of Kansas City and particularly the Latino population?
Yes, these so-called urban revitalization projects were supposed to be projects that were sold to the community as having the opportunity to attract new investments, new businesses, new residents, and certain type of residents to the downtown and inner city areas. They often involve large-scale demolition, displacement, and gentrification of low-income and minority neighborhoods, including Latino neighborhoods. Some examples in Kansas City that everybody must be familiar with are the Power and Light District, the Crossroads Arts District, and even the West Side Redevelopment Plan. And the impacts of our Latino community are still felt up to this day. These communities have faced losses of affordable housing, cultural erasure, environmental hazards, and lack of political representation. And they have resisted then and continue to resist and continue to try to negotiate with dominant forces of urban development using the strategies of community organizing, coalition building, cultural activism, legal action.
And this has been so important, particularly in some of the conversations that we're having in Kansas City right now, where they want to build a new Royal Stadium. And for our listeners outside of Kansas City, this is the baseball team, and they want to build a new Royal Stadium, and these kinds of conversations about who will be impacted, who will actually benefit. So for instance, some of the small business owners around the Crossroads area, which is one of the neighborhoods in Kansas City, appear not to be as happy about the proposed location of the Royal Stadium. Just to highlight that so much of this conversation that we're having today is a conversation we've had in the past, that we need to interrogate how much money is being spent and for whom and who is benefiting. And so thank you for highlighting that and bringing that to this conversation.
So I think one of the important lessons from this conversation is that communities, as you have so eloquently put it, have organized and resisted rather than have been passive subjects of economic and city policymaking. Could you elaborate that in the most, in recent time, more clearly? I think I'm putting on my organizer hat now, and I've often thought to myself, what can we do to better reach out to the Latino community in Kansas City? For me, there's a language barrier. I don't speak Spanish. It's not one of my languages. What can we do to better empower, especially undocumented residents? Clara, could you comment on that?
Oh, wow, yes. Indeed. I'm very glad that through this work, Alejandro Garay and I were able to identify and bring to visibility the agency, the flexibility, and the resilience that Latino communities in Kansas City have had in the face of these various challenges posed by the different social structures of accumulation that we have discussed and the institutional arrangements and their effects on these communities. All throughout and in these different periods, Latinos have engaged in community building practices such as forming labor unions, creating cultural and political organizations, developing and supporting ethnic businesses and markets and festivities, and preserving and nurturing their cultural identity and heritage. And that all of those have also contributed to placemaking, the creation of places that we now identify as places that are embedded by this Latino culture. And of course, there are contradictions and tensions also that exist within Latino communities, and a lot of structural barriers and inequalities and difficulties that limit their opportunities and well-being. And also, as you're saying, Taki, the opportunities that others have to become better allies to these communities. How can we better support, help, contribute to, nurture, elevate these communities? We need to continue working on inter and intra-ethnic cooperation and understanding of each other, working as allies for each other, realizing that the causes that some groups have should be also the causes of everybody, and that if we support the well-being of a particular community that have been historically disenfranchised, we're also helping others in the process. This is particularly perhaps interesting to comment on this week that we're celebrating Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy. And that was his message, that we need to support each other in this struggle because we're in it together.
Clara, what a fascinating research. And I thank you so much. I learned so much from this conversation and from reading your work. And thank you for bringing these issues to light and conversing with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Clara.
Thank you very much.
The views and opinions aired by the hosts and guests on the show do not reflect those of their employers, KKFI, or its board.
Mil veces venceremos, del cielo al suelo y del suelo al cielo vamos.